Chapter 17. The Closing Circle. It did not stop disturbing him. It was a matter that grew in mind as the days of preparation sped by. It interposed itself between him and Twissel, then between him and Noyes. When the day of departure came, he was only distantly aware of the fact. It was all he could do to rouse a shadow of interest when Twissel returned from a session with the council subcommittee. He said, "How did it go?" Twissel said wearily, "It wasn't exactly the most pleasant conversation I've ever had." Harlan was almost willing to let it go at that, but he broke his moment's silence with a muttered, "I suppose you said nothing about—"
"No, no," was the testy response. "I said nothing about the girl, or about your part in the misdirection of Cooper. It was an unfortunate error, a mechanical failure. I took full responsibility."
Harlan's conscience, burdened as it was, could find room for a twinge. He said, "That won't affect you well."
"What can they do? They must wait for the correction to be made before they can touch me. If we fail, we're all beyond help or harm. If we succeed, success itself will probably protect me. And if it doesn't..."
The old man shrugged.
"I plan to retire from active participation in Eternity's affairs thereafter anyway."
But he fumbled his cigarette and disposed of it before it was half burned away. He sighed.
"I would rather not have brought them into this at all, but there would have been no way otherwise of using the special kettle for further trips past the downwind terminus."
Harlan turned away. His thoughts moved around and about the same channels that had been occupied to the increasing exclusion of all else for days. He heard Twissel's further remark dimly, but it was only at its repetition that he said with a start, "Pardon me?
I say, is your woman ready, boy? Does she understand what she's to do?"
"She's ready. I've told her everything."
"How did she take it?"
"What? Oh, yes, as I expected her to. She's not afraid."
"It's less than 3 physio hours now."
"I know."
That was all for the moment, and Harlan was left alone with his thoughts and a sickening realization of what he must do. With the kettle loading done and the controls adjusted, Harlan and Noyes appeared in a final change of costume, approximating that of an unurbanized area of the early 20th. Noyes had modified Harlan's suggestion for her wardrobe, according to some instinctive feeling she claimed women had when it came to matters of clothing and aesthetics. She chose thoughtfully from pictures in the advertisements of the appropriated volumes of the news magazine and had minutely scrutinized items imported from a dozen different centuries. Occasionally she would say to Harlan, "What do you think?" He would shrug. "If it's instinctive knowledge, I'll leave it to you."
"That's a bad sign, Andrew," she said,
with a lightness that did not quite ring true.
"You're too pliable. What's the matter anyway? You're just not yourself. You haven't been for days."
"I'm all right," Harlan said in a monotone.
Twissel's first sight of them in the role of natives of the 20th elicited a feeble attempt at jocularity.
"Father Time," he said. "What ugly costumes in the primitive, and yet how it fails to hide your beauty, my dear."
Noyes smiled warmly at him, and Harlan, standing there impassively silent, was forced to admit that Twissel's rust-choked vein of gallantry had something of truth in it. Noyes's clothing encompassed her without accentuating her as clothing should. Her makeup was confined to unimaginative dabs of color on lips and cheeks and an ugly rearrangement of the eyebrow line. Her lovely hair, this had been the worst of it, had been cut ruthlessly. Yet she was beautiful. Harlan himself was already growing accustomed to his own uncomfortable belt, the tightness of fit under armpits and in the crotch, and the mousy lack of color about his rough-textured clothing. Wearing strange costumes to suit a century was an old story to him. Twissel was saying,
"Now what I really wanted to do was to install hand controls inside the kettle as we discussed, but there isn't any way, apparently. The engineers simply must have a source of power large enough to handle temporal displacement, and that isn't available outside eternity. Temporal tension, while occupying the primitive, is all that can be managed. However, we have a return lever.
He led them into the kettle, picking his way among the piled supplies, and pointed out the obtruding finger of metal that now marred the smooth inner wall of the kettle.
"It amounts to the installation of a simple switch," he said. "Instead of returning automatically to eternity, the kettle will remain in the primitive indefinitely. Once the lever is plunged home, however, you will return. There will then be the matter of the second and, I hope, final trip."
"A second trip?" asked Noyes at once.
Harlan said, "I haven't explained that. Look, this first trip is intended merely to fix the time of Cooper's arrival precisely. We don't know how long a time lapse exists between his arrival and the placing of the advertisement. We'll reach him by the post office box and learn, if possible, the exact minute of his arrival, or as close as we can anyway. We can then return to that moment plus 15 minutes to allow for the kettle to have left Cooper."
Twissel interposed. "Couldn't have the kettle in the same place at the same time in two different physiotimes, you know,"
and tried to smile. Noyes seemed to absorb it.
"I see," she said, not too definitely.
Twissel said to Noyes, "Picking up Cooper at the time of his arrival will reverse all micro-changes. The A-bomb advertisement will disappear again, and Cooper will know only that the kettle, having disappeared as we told him it would, had unexpectedly appeared again. He will not know that he was in the wrong century, and he will not be told. We will tell him that there was some vital instruction we had forgotten to give him. We'll have to manufacture some. And we can only hope that he will regard the matter as so unimportant that he won't mention being sent back twice when he writes his memoir."
Noyes lifted her plucked eyebrows. "It's very complicated."
"Yes, unfortunately."
He rubbed his hands together and looked at the others as though nursing an inner doubt. Then he straightened, produced a fresh cigarette, and even managed a certain jauntiness as he said, "And now, boy, good luck."
Twissel touched hands briefly with Harlan, nodded to Noyes, and stepped out of the kettle.
"Are we leaving now?"
asked Noyes of Harlan when they were alone.
"In a few minutes," said Harlan.
He glanced sideways at Noyes. She was looking up at him, smiling, unfrightened. Momentarily, his own spirits responded to that.
But that was emotion, not reason, he counseled himself, instinct, not thought.
He looked away. The trip was nothing, or almost nothing, no different from an ordinary kettle ride. Midway, there was a kind of internal jar that might have been the downwind terminus and might have been purely psychosomatic. It was barely noticeable. And then they were in the primitive, and they stepped into a craggy, lonely world brightened by the splendor of an afternoon sun. There was a soft wind with a chilly edge to it,
and most of all, silence. The bare rocks were tumbled and mighty, colored into dull rainbows by compounds of iron, copper, and chromium. The grandeur of the manless and all but lifeless surroundings dwarfed and shriveled Harlan. Eternity, which did not belong to the world of matter, had no sun and none but imported air. His memories of his own home when were dim. His observations in the various centuries had dealt with men and their cities. He had never experienced this.
Noyes touched his elbow.
"Andrew, I'm cold."
He turned to her with a start.
She said, "Hadn't we better set up the radiant?"
He said, "Yes, in Cooper's cavern."
"Do you know where it is?"
"It's right here," he said shortly. He had no doubt of that. The memoir had located it, and first Cooper, now he, had been pinpointed back to it. He had not doubted precision pinpointing in time travel since his cubhood days. He remembered himself then, facing Educator Yarrow seriously, saying, "But Earth moves about the sun, and the sun moves about the galactic center, and the galaxy moves too. If you start from some point on Earth, and move down when 100 years, you'll be in empty space, because it will take 100 years for Earth to reach that point." Those were the days when he still referred to a century as 100 years. And Educator Yarrow had snapped back,
"You don't separate time from space. Moving through time, you share Earth's motions. Or do you believe that a bird flying through the air whiffs out into space because the Earth is hurrying around the sun at 18 miles a second and vanishes from under the creature?"
Arguing from analogy is risky, but Harlan obtained more rigorous proof in later days, and now, after a scarcely precedented trip into the primitive, he could turn confidently and feel no surprise at finding the opening precisely where he had been told it would be. He moved the camouflage of loose rubble and rock to one side and entered. He probed the darkness within, using the white beam of his flash almost like a scalpel. He scoured the walls, ceiling, floor, every inch. Noyes, remaining close behind him, whispered,
"What are you looking for?"
He said, "Something, anything." He found his something anything at the very rear of the cave in the shape of a flattish stone covering greenish sheets like a paperweight. Harlan threw the stone aside and flipped the sheets past one thumb.
"What are they?"
asked Noyes. "Banknotes. Medium of exchange, money."
"Did you know they were there?"
"I knew nothing, I just hoped." It was only a matter of using Twissell's reverse logic of calculating cause from effect. Eternity existed, so Cooper must be making correct decisions too. In assuming the advertisement would pull Harlan into the correct time, the cave was an obvious additional means of communication. Yet this was almost better than he had dared hope. More than once during the preparations for his trip into the primitive, Harlan had thought that making his way into a town with nothing but bullion in his possession would result in suspicion and delay. Cooper had managed, to be sure, but Cooper had had time. Harlan hefted the sheaf of bills, and he must have used time to accumulate this much. He had done well, the youngster, marvelously well. And the circle was closing. The supplies had been moved into the cave, in the increasingly ruddy glow of the westering sun. The kettle had been covered by a diffuse reflecting film which would hide it from any but the closest of prying eyes, and Harlan had a blaster to take care of those, if need be. The radiant was set up in the cave, and the flash was wedged into a crevice so that they had heat and light. Outside, it was a chill March night. Noyes stared thoughtfully into the smooth paraboloid interior of the radiant as it slowly rotated. She said,
"Andrew, what are your plans?"
"Tomorrow morning," he said, "I'll leave for the nearest town. I know where it is, or should be." He changed it back to "is" in his mind. There would be no trouble. Twissell's logic again.
"I'll come with you, won't I?"
He shook his head. "You can't speak the language, for one thing, and the trip will be difficult enough for one to negotiate." Noyes looked strangely archaic in her short hair, and the sudden anger in her eyes made Harlan look away uneasily.
She said, "I'm no fool, Andrew. You scarcely speak to me. You don't look at me. What is it? Is your home when morality taking hold? Do you feel you have betrayed eternity, and are you blaming me for that? Do you feel I have corrupted you? What is it?"
He said, "You don't know what I feel." She said,
"Then describe it. You might as well. You'll never have a chance as good as this one. Do you feel love for me? You couldn't, or you wouldn't be using me as a scapegoat. Why did you bring me here? Tell me. Why not have left me in eternity, since you have no use for me here, and since it seems you can hardly bear the sight of me? Harlan muttered,
There's danger.
Oh, come now.
It's more than danger. It's a nightmare. Computer Twistle's nightmare, said Harlan. It was during our last panicky flash up when, into the hidden centuries, that he told me of thoughts he had had concerning those centuries. He speculated on the possibility of evolved varieties of man, new species, supermen perhaps, hiding in the far up when, cutting themselves off from our interference, plotting to end our tamperings with reality. He thought it was they who built the barrier across the 100,000th. Then we found you, and Computer Twistle abandoned his nightmare. He decided there had never been a barrier. He returned to the more immediate problem of salvaging eternity. But I, you see, had been infected by his nightmare. I had experienced the barrier, so I knew it existed. No Eternal had built it, for Twistle said such a thing was theoretically impossible. Maybe Eternity's theories didn't go far enough. The barrier was there. Someone had built it. Or something. Of course, he went on thoughtfully. Twistle was wrong in some ways. He felt that man must evolve, but that's not so. Paleontology is not one of the sciences that interest Eternals, but it interested the late primitives, so I picked up a bit of it myself. I know this much. Species evolve only to meet the pressures of new environments. In a stable environment, a species may remain unchanged for millions of centuries. Primitive man evolved rapidly because his environment was a harsh and changing one. Once, however, mankind learned to create his own environment, he created a pleasant and stable one, so he just naturally stopped evolving.
I don't know what you're talking about, said Noyes, sounding not the least mollified. And you're not saying anything about us, which is what I want to talk about.
Harlan managed to remain outwardly unmoved. He said, Now why the barrier at the 100,000th? What purpose did it serve? You weren't harmed. What other meaning could it have, I asked myself. What happened because of its presence that would not have happened had it been absent? He paused, looking at his clumsy and heavy boots of natural leather. It occurred to him that he could add to his comfort by removing them for the night, but not now. Not now. He said, There was only one answer to that question. The existence of that barrier sent me raving back down when to get a neuronic whip, to assault Finge. It fired me to the thought of risking eternity to get you back, and smashing eternity when I thought I had failed. Do you see? Noyes stared at him with a mixture of horror and disbelief.
Do you mean the people in the Upwen wanted you to do all that? They planned it?
Yes. Don't look at me like that, yes. And don't you see how it makes everything different? As long as I acted on my own, for reasons of my own, I'll take all the consequences, material and spiritual. But to be fooled into it, to be tricked into it, by people handling and manipulating my emotions as though I were a computerplex on which it was only necessary to insert the properly perforated foils. Harlan realized suddenly that he was shouting, and stopped abruptly. He let a few moments pass, then said,
That is impossible to take.
I've got to undo what I was marionetted into doing, and when I undo it, I will be able to rest again. And he would. Perhaps. He could feel the coming of an impersonal triumph, dissociated from the personal tragedy which lay behind and ahead. The circle was closing. Noyes's hand reached out uncertainly, as though to take his own rigid, unyielding one. Harlan drew away, avoided her sympathy. He said,
It had all been arranged. My meeting with you, everything. My emotional makeup had been analyzed, obviously. Action and response. Push this button, and the man will do that. Push that button, and he will do this.
Harlan was speaking with difficulty, out of the depths of shame. He shook his head, trying to shake the horror of it away as a dog would water, then went on.
One thing I didn't understand at first. How did I come to guess that Cooper was to be sent back into the primitive? It was a most unlikely thing to guess. I had no basis. Twistle didn't understand it. More than once he wondered how I could have done it with so little understanding of mathematics. Yet I had. The first time was that night. You were asleep, but I wasn't. I had the feeling then that there was something I must remember, some remark, some thought, something that I had caught sight of in the excitement and exhilaration of the evening. When I thought long, the whole significance of Cooper sprang into my mind, and along with it, the thought entered my mind that I was in a position to destroy eternity. Later I checked through histories of mathematics, but it was unnecessary, really. I already knew. I was certain of it. How? How? Noyes stared at him intently. She didn't try to touch him now. Do you mean the men of the Hidden Centuries arranged that, too? They put it all in your mind, then maneuvered you properly?
Yes.
Yes. Nor are they done. There is still work for them to do. The circle may be closing, but it is not yet closed. How can they do anything now? They're not here with us.
No.
He said the word in so hollow a voice that Noyes paled.
Invisible super things, she whispered.
Not super things. Not invisible. I told you man would not evolve while he controlled his own environment. The people of the Hidden Centuries are Homo sapiens.
Ordinary people.
Then they're certainly not here. Harlan said sadly,
You're here, Noyes.
Yes, and you, and no one else.
You and I, agreed Harlan.
No one else. A woman of the Hidden Centuries and I.
Don't act any more, Noyes, please.
She stared at him with horror.
What are you saying, Andrew?
What I must say.
What were you saying that evening, when you gave me the peppermint drink? You were talking to me, your soft voice.
Soft words, I heard nothing, not consciously. But I remember your delicate voice whispering.
About what?
The downwind journey of Cooper. The Samson smash of eternity, am I right?
Noyes said,
I don't even know what Samson smash means.
You can guess very accurately, Noyes. Tell me, when did you enter the 482nd? Whom did you replace? Or did you just squeeze in? I had your life plot worked out by an expert in the 2456th. In the new reality, you had no existence at all, no analog. Strange for such a small change, but not impossible. And then the life plotter said one thing which I heard with my ears, but not with my mind. Strange that I should remember it. Perhaps even then something clanged in my mind, but I was too full of you to listen. He said, with the combination of factors you handed me, I don't quite see how she fit in the old reality.
He was right. You didn't fit in. You were an invader from the far up when, manipulating me, and Finge too, to suit yourself.
Noyes said urgently,
Andrew!
It all fit in, if I had the eyes to look. A book film in your house entitled Social and Economic History. It surprised me when I first saw it. You needed it, didn't you, to teach you how best to be a woman of the century. Another item. Our first trip into the Hidden Centuries, remember? You stopped the kettle at the 111,394th. You stopped it. With finesse. Without fumbling. Where did you learn to control a kettle? If you were what you seemed to be, that would have been your first trip in a kettle. Why the 111,394th anyway? Was it your home when?
She said softly, Why did you bring me to the primitive, Andrew?
He shouted suddenly,
To protect eternity! I could not tell what damage you might do there! Here you are helpless because I know you. Admit that all I say is true. Admit it.
He rose in a paroxysm of wrath, arm upraised. She did not flinch. She was utterly calm. She might have been modeled out of warm, beautiful wax. Harlan did not complete his motion. He said,
Admit it!
She said, Are you so uncertain, after all your deductions? What will it matter to you whether I admit it or not? Harlan felt the wildness mount.
Admit it anyway, so that I need feel no pain at all, none at all.
Pain?
Because I have a blaster, Noyes, and it is my intention to kill you.
Chapter 18. The Beginning of Infinity. There was a crawling uncertainty inside Harlan, an irresolution that was consuming him. He had the blaster in his hand. It was aimed at Noyes. But why did she say nothing? Why did she persist in this impassive attitude? How could he kill her? How could he not kill her? He said hoarsely,
Well?
She moved, but it was only to clasp her hands loosely in her lap, to look more relaxed, more aloof. When she spoke, her voice seemed scarcely that of a human being. Facing the muzzle of a blaster, it yet gained assurance and took on an almost mystic quality of impersonal strength. She said, You cannot wish to kill me only in order to protect eternity. If that were your desire, you could stun me, tie me firmly, pin me within this cave, and then take to your travels in the dawn. Or you might have asked Computer Twistle to keep me in solitary confinement during your absence in the primitive. Or you might take me with you at dawn, lose me in the wastes. If it is only killing that will satisfy you, it is only because you think that I have betrayed you, that I have tricked you into love first, in order that I might trick you into treason later. This is murder out of wounded pride, and not at all the just retribution you tell yourself it is. Harlan squirmed.
Are you from the Hidden Centuries, tell me?
Noyes said, I am. Will you now blast? Harlan's finger trembled on the blaster's contact point, yet he hesitated. Something irrational within him could still plead her case and point up the remnants of his own futile love and longing. Was she desperate at his rejection of her? Was she deliberately courting death by lying? Was she indulging in foolish heroics born of despair at his doubts of her? No. The book films of the sickly sweet literary tradition of the 289th might have it so, but not a girl like Noyes. She was not one to meet her death at the hands of a false lover with the joyful masochism of a broken, bleeding lily. Then was she scornfully denying his ability to kill her for any reason whatever? Was she confidently relying on the attraction she knew she had for him, even now, certain that it would immobilize him, freeze him in weakness and shame? That hit too closely. His finger clamped a bit harder on the contact. Noyes spoke again. You're waiting. Does that mean you expect me to enter a brief for the defense?
What defense?
Harlan tried to make that scornful, yet he welcomed the diversion. It could postpone the moment when he must look down upon her blasted body, upon whatever remnants of bloody flesh might remain, and know that what had been done to his beautiful Noyes had been done by his own hand. He found excuses for his delay. He thought feverishly, Let her talk. Let her tell what she can about the Hidden Centuries, so much better protection for eternity. It put a front of firm policy on his action, and for the moment he could look at her with as calm a face almost as she looked at him. Noyes might have read his mind. She said, Do you want to know about the Hidden Centuries? If that will be a defense, it is easily done. Would you like to know, for instance, why Earth is empty of mankind after the 150,000th? Would you be interested? Harlan wasn't going to plead for knowledge, nor was he going to buy knowledge. He had the blaster. He was very intent on no show of weakness. He said,
Talk!
And flushed at the little smile which was her first response to his exclamation. She said, "At a moment in physio-time before eternity had reached very far up when, before it had reached even the 10,000th, we of our century, and you're right, it was the 111,394th, learned of eternity's existence. We, too, had time travel, you see, but it was based on a completely different set of postulates than yours, and we preferred to view time rather than shifting mass. Furthermore, we dealt with our past only, our down when. We discovered eternity indirectly. First, we developed the calculus of realities and tested our own reality through it. We were amazed to find we lived in a reality of rather low probability. It was a serious question. Why such an improbable reality? You seem abstracted, Andrew. Are you interested at all?" Harlan heard her say his name with all the intimate tenderness she had used in weeks past. It should grate on him now, anger him with its cynical faithlessness. And yet, it didn't. He said desperately, "Go on and get it over with, woman." He tried to balance the warmth of her, Andrew, with the chill anger of his woman. And yet, she only smiled again, pallidly. She said, "We searched back through time and came across the growing eternity. It seemed obvious to us almost at once that there had been at one point in physio-time, a conception we have also but under another name, another reality. The other reality, the one of maximum probability, we call the basic state. The basic state had encompassed us once, or had encompassed our analogues at least. At the time, we could not say what the nature of the basic state was. We could not possibly know. We did know, however, that some change initiated by eternity in the far down when had managed, through the workings of statistical chance, to alter the basic state all the way up to our century and beyond. We set about determining the nature of the basic state, intending to undo the evil, if evil it was. First, we set up the quarantined area you call the hidden centuries, isolating the eternals on the down-when side of the 70,000th. This armor of isolation would protect us from all but a vanishingly small percentage of the changes being made. It wasn't absolute security, but it gave us time. We next did something our culture and ethics did not ordinarily allow us to do. We investigated our own future. Our up when. We learned the destiny of man in the reality that actually existed in order that we might compare it, eventually, with the basic state. Somewhere, past the 125,000th, mankind solved the secret of the interstellar drive. They learned how to manage the jump through hyperspace. Finally, mankind could reach the stars. Harlan was listening in growing absorption to her measured words. How much truth was there in all this? How much was a calculated attempt to deceive him? He tried to break the spell by speaking, by breaking the smooth flow of her sentences. He said, "And once they could reach the stars, they did so and left the earth. Some of us have guessed that." "Then some of you have guessed wrong. Man tried to leave earth. Unfortunately, however, we are not alone in the galaxy. There are other stars with other planets, you know. There are even other intelligences. None in this galaxy, at least, are as ancient as mankind, but in the 125,000 centuries man remained on Earth, younger minds caught up and passed us, developed the interstellar drive, and colonized the galaxy. When we moved out into space, the signs were up. Occupied. No trespassing. Clear out. Mankind drew back its exploratory feelers, remained at home. But now, he knew Earth for what it was. A prison, surrounded by an infinity of freedom. And mankind died out." Harlan said, "Just died out. Nonsense." "They didn't just die out.
it took thousands of centuries. There were ups and downs, but on the whole, there was a loss of purpose, a sense of futility, a feeling of hopelessness that could not be overcome. Eventually, there was one last decline of the birth rate, and finally, extinction. Your eternity did that. Harlan could defend eternity now, the more intensely and extravagantly for having so shortly before attacked it so keenly. He said, "Let us at the hidden centuries, and we will correct that. We have not failed yet to achieve the greatest good in those centuries we could reach."
"The greatest good?" asked Noyes, in a detached tone that seemed to make a mockery of the phrase.
"What is that?"
"Your machines tell you. Your computerplexes. But who adjusts the machines and tells them what to weigh in the balance? The machines do not solve problems with greater insight than men do, only faster."
"Only faster.
Then what is it the Eternals consider good?"
"I'll tell you. Safety and security. Moderation. Nothing in excess. No risks without overwhelming certainty of an adequate return."
Harlan swallowed. With sudden force he remembered Twissel's words in the kettle while talking about the evolved men of the hidden centuries. He said,
"We bred out the unusual."
"And wasn't it so?"
"Well," said Noyes, "you seem to be thinking. Think of this, then. In the reality that now exists, why is it that man is continually attempting space travel and continually failing? Surely each space travel era must know of previous failures. Why try again, then?"
Harlan said, "I haven't studied the matter." But he thought uneasily of the colonies on Mars, established again and again, always failing. He thought of the odd attraction that spaceflight always had, even for Eternals. He could hear sociologist Cantor Voy of the 2456th sighing at the loss of electrogravitic spaceflight in one century and saying longingly, "It had been very beautiful." And life plotter Niran Farouk, who had sworn bitterly at its passing and had launched into a fit of railing at Eternity's handling of anti-cancer serums to ease his spirit. Was there such a thing as an instinctive yearning on the part of intelligent beings to expand outward, to reach the stars, to leave the prison of gravity behind? Was it that which forced man to develop interplanetary travel dozens of times, forced him to travel over and over again to the dead worlds of a solar system in which only Earth was livable? Was it the eventual failure, the knowledge that one must return to the home prison, that brought about the maladjustments that Eternity was forever fighting? Harlan thought of the drug addiction in those same futile centuries of the electrogravitics. Noyes said, "In ironing out the disasters of reality, Eternity rules out the triumphs as well. It is in meeting the great tests that mankind can most successfully rise to great heights. Out of danger and restless insecurity comes the force that pushes mankind to newer and loftier conquests. Can you understand that? Can you understand that in averting the pitfalls and miseries that beset man, Eternity prevents men from finding their own bitter and better solutions, the real solutions that come from conquering difficulty, not avoiding it?" Harlan began woodenly.
"The greatest good of the greatest number,"
Noyes cut in.
"Suppose Eternity had never been established."
"Well?"
"I'll tell you what would have happened. The energies that went into temporal engineering would have gone into nucleonics instead. Eternity would not have come, but the interstellar drive would. Man would have reached the stars more than 100,000 centuries before he did in this current reality. The stars would then have been untenanted, and mankind would have established itself throughout the galaxy. We would have been first."
"And what would have been gained?" asked Harlan doggedly. "Would we be happier?"
"Whom do you mean by we? Man would not be a world, but a million worlds, a billion worlds.
we would have the infinite in our grasp. Each world would have its own stretch of the centuries, each its own values, a chance to seek happiness after ways of its own in an environment of its own. There are many happinesses, many goods, infinite variety. That is the basic state of mankind.
You're guessing, said Harlan, and he was angry at himself for feeling attraction for the picture she had conjured. How can you tell what would have happened?
Noyes said, You smile at the ignorance of the timers who know only one reality. We smile at the ignorance of the Eternals who think there are many realities, but that only one exists at a time.
What does that gibberish mean?
We don't calculate alternate realities. We view them. We see them in their state of non-reality.
A kind of ghostly never-never land where the might-have-beens play with the ifs?
Without the sarcasm, yes.
And how do you do that?
Noyes paused, then said, How can I explain that, Andrew? I have been educated to know certain things without really understanding all about them, just as you have. Can you explain the workings of a computerplex? Yet you know it exists and works.
Harlan flushed. Well then?
Noyes said, We learned to view realities, and we found basic state to be as I have described. We found, too, the change that had destroyed basic state. It was not any change that eternity had initiated. It was the establishment of eternity itself, the mere fact of its existence. Any system like eternity, which allows men to choose their own future, will end by choosing safety and mediocrity, and in such a reality the stars are out of reach. The mere existence of eternity at once wiped out the galactic empire. To restore it, eternity must be done away with. The number of realities is infinite. The number of any subclass of realities is also infinite. For instance, the number of realities containing eternity is infinite. The number in which eternity does not exist is infinite. The number in which eternity does exist but is abolished is also infinite. But my people chose from among the infinite a group that involved me. I had nothing to do with that. They educated me for my job as Twissel and yourself educated Cooper for his job. But the number of realities in which I was the agent in destroying eternity was also infinite. I was offered a choice among five realities that seemed least complex. I chose this one, the one involving you, the only reality system involving you.
Harlan said, Why did you choose it?
Noyes looked away. Because I loved you, you see. I loved you long before I met you.
Harlan was shaken. She said it with such depths of sincerity. He thought sickly, she's an actress. He said, That's rather ridiculous.
Is it? I studied the realities at my disposal. I studied the reality in which I went back to the 482nd, met first Finge, then you, the one in which you came to me and loved me, in which you took me into eternity, and the far up when of my own century in which you misdirected Cooper, and in which you and I, together, returned to the primitive. We lived in the primitive for the rest of our days. I saw our lives together and they were happy, and I loved you. So it's not ridiculous at all. I chose this alternative so that our love might be true.
Harlan said, All this is false. It's false. How can you expect me to believe you? He stopped, then said suddenly, Wait. You say you knew all this in advance. All that would happen.
Yes.
Then you're obviously lying. You would have known that I would have you here at Blaster Point. You would have known you would fail. What is your answer to that?
She sighed lightly. I told you there are an infinite number of any subclass of realities. No matter how finely we focus on a given reality, it always represents an infinite number of very similar realities. There are fuzzy spots. The finer we focus, the less fuzzy. But perfect sharpness cannot be obtained. the less fuzzy, the lower the probability of chance variations spoiling the result. But the probability is never absolutely zero. One fuzzy spot spoiled things.
Which?
You were to have come back to the far up when, after the barrier at the 100,000th had been lowered, and you did. But you were to have come back alone. It was for that reason that I was momentarily so startled at seeing Computer Twistle with you. Again, Harlan was troubled. How she made things fit in.
Noyes said,
I would have been even more startled had I realized the significance of that alteration in full. Had you come alone, you would have brought me back to the primitive as you did. Then, for love of humanity, for love of me, you would have left Cooper untouched. Your circle would have been broken. Eternity ended. Our life together here, safe. But you came with Twistle, a chance variation. While coming, he talked to you of his thoughts about the hidden centuries and started you on a train of deductions that ended with your doubting my good faith. It ended with a blaster between us. And now, Andrew, that's the story. You may blast me. There is nothing to stop you.
Harlan's hand ached from its spastic grasp on the blaster. He shifted it dizzily to the other hand. Was there no flaw in her story? Where was the resolution he was to have gained from knowing certainly that she was a creature of the hidden centuries? He was more than ever tearing at himself in conflict, and dawn was approaching. He said, Why two efforts to end eternity? Why couldn't eternity have ended once and for all when I sent Cooper back to the 20th? Things would have ended then, and there would not have been this agony of uncertainty.
Because, said Noyes, ending this eternity is not enough. We must reduce the probability of establishing any form of eternity to as near zero as we can manage. So there is one thing we must do here in the primitive, a small change, a little thing. You know what a minimum necessary change is like. It is only a letter to a peninsula called Italy, here in the 20th. It is now the 19.32nd. In a few centicenturies, provided I send the letter, a man of Italy will begin experimenting with the neutronic bombardment of uranium.
Harlan found himself horrified. You will alter primitive history?
Yes. It is our intention. In the new reality, the final reality, the first nuclear explosion will take place not in the 30th century, but in the 19.45th.
But do you know the danger? Can you possibly estimate the danger?
We know the danger. We have viewed the sheaf of resulting realities. There is a probability, not a certainty, of course, that Earth will end with a largely radioactive crust. But before that...
You mean there can be compensation for that?
A galactic empire. An actual intensification of the basic state.
Yet you accuse the Eternals of interfering.
We accuse them of interfering many times to keep mankind safely at home and in prison. We interfere once, to turn him prematurely to nucleonics, so that he might never establish an eternity.
No, said Harlan desperately. There must be an eternity.
If you choose. It is yours to choose. If you wish to have psychopaths dictate the future of man...
Psychopaths! Exploded Harlan.
Aren't they? You know them. Think.
Harlan stared at her in outraged horror, yet he could not help thinking. He thought of Cubs learning the truth about reality, and Club La Tourette trying to kill himself as a result. La Tourette had survived to become an Eternal with what scars on his personality none could say, yet helping to decide on alternate realities. He thought of the caste system in Eternity, of the abnormal life that turned guilt feelings into anger and hatred against technicians. He thought of computers struggling against themselves, of Finge intriguing against Twistle, and Twistle spying on Finge. He thought of Senor, fighting his bald head by fighting all the Eternals. He thought of himself,
Then he thought of Twistle, the great Twistle, also breaking the laws of eternity. It was as though he had always known eternity to be all this. Why else should he have been so willing to destroy it? Yet he had never admitted it to himself fully. He had never looked it clearly in the face until suddenly, now. And he saw eternity with great clarity as a sink of deepening psychoses, a writhing pit of abnormal motivation, a mass of desperate lives torn brutally out of context. He looked blankly at Noyes. She said, softly, "Do you see? Come to the mouth of the cave with me, Andrew." He followed her, hypnotized, appalled at the completeness with which he had gained a new viewpoint. His blaster fell away from the line connecting it and Noyes's heart for the first time. The pale streakings of dawn grayed the sky, and the bulking kettle just outside the cave was an oppressive shadow against the pallor. Its outlines were dulled and blurred by the film thrown over it. Noyes said, "This is Earth, not the eternal and only home of mankind, but only a starting point of an infinite adventure. All you need do is make the decision. It is yours to make. You and I and the contents of this cave will be protected by a physio-time field against the change. Cooper will disappear along with his advertisement. Eternity will go, and the reality of my century. But we will remain to have children and grandchildren, and mankind will remain to reach the stars." He turned to look at her, and she was smiling at him. It was Noyes as she had been, and his own heart beating as it had used to. He wasn't even aware that he had made his decision until the grayness suddenly invaded all the sky as the hulk of the kettle disappeared from against it. With that disappearance, he knew, even as Noyes moved slowly into his arms, came the end, the final end of eternity, and the beginning of infinity.
This has been a presentation of BBC Audiobooks America. For more information on related titles from BBC Audiobooks America, please visit us online at bbcaudiobooksamerica.com. The End of Eternity. Text copyright 1955 by Isaac Asimov. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010 by BBC Audiobooks America. All rights reserved.